Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and a production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. It's made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellard Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. A child may not remember, but the body remembers. Resilience is the biology of stress, and The Science of Hope is a one-hour documentary that delves into the science of adverse childhood experiences, otherwise known as ACEs, and the birth of a new movement to treat and prevent toxic stress. While the original research was controversial, experts now consider the findings to have revealed one of the most important public health findings of the generation. Understood to be one of the leading causes of everything from heart disease and cancer to substance abuse and depression, extremely stressful experiences in childhood can alter brain development and have lifelong effects on health and behavior. Thank you. My guests today are going to share more about this topic, the research behind it, and how they are using research in their own work locally. I'm joined today by Dr. Nisha Abdul-Qadir, child abuse pediatrician for the County of San Luis Obispo and consulting pediatrician for Martha's Place Children's Center, and Ron Huxley, a licensed marriage and family therapist who provides faith-based trauma-informed therapy for individuals and families. Today's show is live, and we invite you to join our conversation with your comments and your questions, and you can do that by calling us at 781-3875. Again, 781-3875. And I want to welcome both of you to today's show.
Thanks for having me here.
Yes, thank you.
So when we're talking about ACEs or the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, can you give me a little bit of background about what that is?
So the ACE study is a sentinel public health study that started in the 1990s and was a collaboration between Dr. Felitti and Kaiser Permanente in San Diego along with the CDC. And it started basically with Dr. Felitti seeing in his obesity clinic that people who, as adults, who lost weight oftentimes gained that weight back. And what he found in his population of a few hundred individuals, that more than half of them had suffered from sexual abuse as a child. And he found that that relationship was astounding. And he felt that what he was seeing there was important, but knew that those numbers weren't going to be big enough. So mm-hmm. he was able to pair up with Dr. Anda at the CDC at that time, who was also looking at similar things. How do our experiences, as specifically as children and young children, affect us as adults? And so they were able to devise and do the ACE study, which then enrolled 17,000 people wow. from Kaiser Permanente. So a huge number mm-hmm. and very statistically
broad,
appropriate. And then the yeah. other thing that I think that's very important to consider is Kaiser. Kaiser is an HMO for working class Americans. So
right.
I mean, we're not looking at a Medi-Cal population. We're not looking at a homeless population. We're looking at working class America.
Right.
And what they were looking at are the ACE scores, are the adverse childhood experiences. And they narrowed those down into 10 different experiences that they'd ask in a questionnaire that was looking at things like neglect, mm-hmm. Physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and then factors in the home such as was there substance abuse issues, was there mental health issues in the family, was there domestic violence, and was anybody incarcerated. So they were looking at those, and people would get one point for each score of the 10 different ACEs. And what they found was that over 60% of people had at least one ACE, but that over 20% had four or more. And that what they saw is that when they compared the number of ACEs somebody had, like their ACE score, the higher the ACE score was, the more likely that person was to be suffering from some sort of ailment. And then as they progressed with the study to see that there was a shorter life expectancy, too.
Oh, it was also a shorter life expectancy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And were they able to follow these individuals for a prolonged period of time in some cases because they stayed with Kaisers?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that as far as the follow-up studies. But I think one of the most important things that comes out of that is not only understanding this connection between the childhood adverse events, but also that the things that happened to them weren't just because of bad decision making. Sometimes we think, oh, okay, a child is in a home and in a poor environment, and then they start to make poor decisions. Maybe they start using substances early. Maybe it leads to other problems. But what they also found were that people that were not making those poor lifestyle choices were also having three times as much lung disease, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. So it wasn't directly related to lifestyle.
Oh, to their own lifestyle.
Correct.
Interesting. And were the traumas dependent on the individual's perception of the trauma, or was there a scale for a definition of the trauma? And I don't know if I'm making myself clear on that.
Right. I mean, this study is really broad, and it was just those 10 questions, very much from recall. So asking adults, what do you remember about your household or things that happened? Okay. So it's a recall, and it wasn't graded as far as how much trauma, as much as just was there, this experience.
And from the standpoint, Ron, of, you know, as a therapist, how does this play into what you've seen working with families and with children?
Yeah, I think trauma is kind of the common denominator for most of the things that I'm seeing both in children and adults, whether we're talking about anxiety or depression, trouble in school, workforce, marital issues. If you dig around a little bit and take some time to work with the individual, begin to see that they had quite a history of trauma, often that they don't even recognize that was considered trauma, because most of the time people minimize those effects in their life and just sort of move on. But many of the people have that as a common denominator.
And there's a new term now, well, not so new, but newer in your field, trauma-informed care. What is that?
Yeah, that has been around a while. However, it's still something that's being understood and in the application of it used. Sometimes it's used just as a way, as a sort of marketing sort of slogan. But the underlying issue is that when we go to provide treatment, it's not just treatment, because it could be policies in a school in terms of how we teach. It could also be how an HR department hires and works with management in a workforce. So trauma-informed care is very broad. It goes across the entire scope of our culture and every institution, religious institutions as well. And basically it says that when we work with individuals who are presenting with various concerns, whether they're mental health issues or their physical health issues, that we begin to keep in mind that there may be trauma that's going on in the background. For example, being aware that a certain way in which a management style is employed in a workforce may actually trigger someone who's been a victim of domestic violence or child abuse. And so there's lots of things like that, that institutions becoming more aware of trauma, i.e. trauma-informed, will help them make better decisions and will improve outcomes within whatever organization that those individuals are engaged in.
Now, do we see I'll go over to you, Dr. Abdul-Kader. You do a lot of work with children who are in abusive situations. And when we think of child abuse, I think it is much broader than seeing children that are beaten. While that is the extreme and certainly horrible, it's much more than that, correct?
Correct. I mean, we look at child abuse or child maltreatment in general. We know that in our country there are about 6 million reports a year, and about a third of those are actually screened in for likely to be abuse and need investigation. We know that the greatest percentage of that, about 80%, are actually neglect. So it's not that physical abuse. And the concern about that is that those are the things that often go unseen, because there's not an outward sign. There's not a bruise that somebody can see.
Right.
or some other kind of a disability that may be related to the abuse. I also think that goes along with that one of the most detrimental types of abuses is emotional abuse, because once again, there's not an outward sign. And unless there are people that are in a child's life that are noticing differences in their behavior or something that's changing in them, maybe school failure, maybe school truancy, whatever, at different stages they may see different things, they may not be picking up that this one factor, which is one of the ACE factors, is substantially affecting their daily life.
When you talk about neglect, can you give examples of what constitutes neglect, the kinds of neglect maybe that you see more frequently that people may not define as neglect?
Yes. So neglect can take many factors. There can be general neglect, so a child that's left alone inappropriately. There can be, you know, definitely neglect that could be extremely dangerous to a child, so a very young child being left alone. One of the most common types of abuse that I evaluate for, it's not necessarily the most common type that we see, but that actually come to me to be seen, are children that are drug endangered children. So children that were either prenatally exposed to a substance, drugs or alcohol, or environmentally exposed in their home environment. Many of those children suffer from neglect because of the drug use environment that's going on around them. They may not be getting medical care. They may not be getting dental care. They may not be having appropriate developmental follow-up. Their food may not be appropriate, and they may not be having appropriate caregivers watching that they're staying safe. So that's unfortunately a very common form of neglect that I'm seeing in our county.
So you just said in our county. So this is certainly a county that, for many people, they see this as a county that kind of holds itself out as being different than a lot of places in California or in the U.S. Do we have problems with neglect?
Absolutely.
Of children here?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And is it limited to people with limited financial resources?
It's not. It goes across all racial and ethnic lines, and it can go. Abuse in general goes through all socioeconomic status as well. Neglect may be seen more often in cases where there are problems with a parent who is trying to provide for a family and has limited resources. Maybe a single mother who's trying to work multiple jobs and take care of children, and having maybe an older child take care of a younger child, or ask just somebody to take care of a child so that she can get done what she needs to get done to keep her family surviving. So those are the cases that may be milder and may be picked up, and then the role is for services to support that family. And like, once again, looking for those factors that can bring in resilience to a family, to support a family, to overcome those barriers that they're facing.
Yeah, and this county is not a low incidence of single parenting, of single mothers that are trying to care for families, correct?
Correct.
I mean, we're pretty much within the statistic for California.
I would think so.
Yeah. And so in your practice, Ron, you've see kids who have the impact of a trauma. What kind of symptoms do you see with kids when they come to you? Are there things that parents can look for? Dr. Abdul-Khader was talking about some of what a pediatrician would see. What about for you?
Yeah, I see similar sort of things. I guess the presenting problem most often are children are having trouble in school. They can't follow rules. They are failing their classes. They are disruptive. They might be having trouble with doing homework, or having some various kind of learning issues going on. So that tends to be a factor I see kids in the school. Or I'll have parents talk about struggles they're having in their own parenting, trying to get the child to follow through on just basic chores, or get ready for bed, or just trying to follow directions, or just the child going through various rages or anger outbursts. So they have a lot of complaints about just disruptions in the normal kind of functioning of day-to-day. But most of the time, they've tried to work with us for quite some time before they come in. So they've tried doing a lot of things on their own to try to make a difference. Oftentimes, a school will encourage the parent to contact me because they see the issues in the parent, either through just maybe embarrassment or a lack of knowledge of resources in the community, isn't reaching out to get some help. And that's where the school often will advocate and encourage them to talk with somebody that might be able to provide them with some support.
How do you define the difference between, say, something like a temper tantrum and a rage outburst?
Yeah, it's a really good question because trauma does affect children developmentally.
Mm-hmm.
So it can affect their ability to manage consequences. It could delay in gratification, can upset it. They can have difficulty in sensory sort of issues, and their environment may feel sort of hostile to them as a result of it. This is very common with children who've gone through in utero drug exposure, drug and alcohol exposure, and we see that a lot. But how do you tell a difference? Sometimes it's not always evident, but usually it's that most children with some interventions, normal interventions by parents in a normal sort of way, will relieve the symptoms.
Can
calm it down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, temperament can play a big factor. So you can have kids who are just a little more high strung or a little more temperamental, a little more feisty, you might say. And
right.
So they're going to maybe react a little differently than maybe a more flexible child or a shyer child. But most parents are able to manage what's going on through some basic parenting tools. They might use some timeout or take away your privileges or use a behavior chart. Generally speaking, the kids that Dr. Abdul-Carter and I see don't respond well to those sort of symptoms, and most behavior plans either at school or work don't seem very effective.
So they almost escalate.
They do. They
yeah.
they escalate, or maybe the tantrum doesn't stop after just a mm-hmm. minute or two, maybe continues on for an hour or two or longer. That can be a real common issue. And a lot of the kids underlying all this have problems with what's called executive functioning skills. They have a inability.
Describe that.
Yeah. That's becoming more and more understood now than it had before. And it's one of the reasons why behavior plans and behavioral modification strategies just don't stick well. And executive functioning skills have to do with that area of the brain that will allow me to plan a task and then be able to initiate something that I planned and then be able to follow through on that task. It allow me to be able to handle my frustration of going through that task and allow me to finish something that I've started. Whereas you see other kids, due to various traumas, will have a difficulty in all those areas. They have trouble starting a task. They can't prioritize. They're unable to finish a task. They will start one task for – I've had kids be told to go put the towels away, and next thing know, the parent finds them in the backyard throwing the stick for the dog. It's like, mm-hmm. where are the towels, and what are you doing out here?
Right.
And so they can't seem to stay on task and follow directions, and they're easily distracted. We commonly put labels on those, but sometimes that really is just trauma that's going on underneath them.
You know, I was just thinking about the labels that we put on those because mm-hmm. we've done shows here that we've had discussions around, and we've talked about kids that are on the spectrum.
Yeah,
we've talked about about kids that that they're discipline issues, mm-hmm. but or kids that need to be medicated, and do we medicate very quickly for this rather than looking at causation? We look at symptom management, if you will.
So I think that's a very important part, and it's something that comes up and is explained very nicely in that in the Resilience DVD and movie. But it's something that I think I live every day as Ron, is that if you hear what Ron's describing, if you just listen to that, that sounds like a child who has ADHD.
Yeah.
Executive mm-hmm. function, impulsivity problems, hyperactivity.
Right. Finding out. Finding them in the backyard, throwing a stick to them.
Yeah, we right. just use that label to describe something we don't understand.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear that with individuals with organic ADHD that mm-hmm. they generally can respond, like the genetic ADHD respond very well to stimulants, and that can be a helpful mm-hmm. Modality for them to succeed, along with, we recommend, some behavioral support as well as therapeutic support. But if you take a child that's been traumatized and is showing these symptoms, what we understand from that trauma is that developmental effect on the brain, where those areas of the more higher thinking, the cognitive thinking, the diplomatic thinking are not developing well, whereas all the development is going on in the midbrain, which is the fight and flight response. And so that area is very, has a very strong response, whereas our executive functioning and our diplomacy is not developing as well. It's not just not having the chance to develop. So we get a child that it seems like they have ADHD, and if we don't know that trauma history, we may be tempted to try stimulants. But it's like putting somebody who's already very stressed and very anxious on a lot of caffeine or something.
Right.
It will make them more dysregulated. So it can be really detrimental to them. And then a lot of times, what do you get? Well, the medicine's not working, so let's try a higher dose, or let's try a different medicine,
right,
because we keep going back to the original set of symptoms, not looking at the underlying need.
Right. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your public radio station for the Central Coast. If you just joined us, today's show is a discussion generated out of a one-hour documentary, Resilience, the Biology of Stress and the Science of Hope, a film that delves into the science of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, and the birth of a new movement to treat and prevent toxic stress. My guests for the discussion are Dr. Nisha Abdul Cotter, child abuse pediatrician for the County of San Luis Obispo and consulting pediatrician for Martha's Place Children's Center; Ron Huxley, a licensed marriage and family therapist who provides faith-based trauma-informed therapy for individuals and families. And you too can be a part of today's discussion. The show is live and we are taking calls. We'd like to hear your comments or questions. These are two professionals that have a lot of information for you. To join us, you can call at 781-3875. Again, that's 805-781-3875. So with the traumatic impact that children have, do you say you also see adults? Are some of these adults coming to you and just really don't have any connection of that traumatic experience of children and what's happening with them in their adult life?
Quite frequently, just in terms of their own lives, they are often kind of unaware that what they went through in childhood, the issues that they had. I mean, they're aware that they may have gone through some type of abuse, or their parents were alcoholics, or there was divorce and a lot of domestic violence. So there's often a lot of, they understand that, but they don't put the connection between what they're currently experiencing and what brought them in for treatment with me or with the doctor, what was going on in them physically, with what occurred to them growing up in childhood or other instances in their young adult life. They don't often put those things together. I have many people who are in their later 60s, 70s, and even some in their 80s who are just now beginning to understand that these are actually related to traumatic incidents that they had in their life, and they just have never really dealt with it, and now they can no longer not deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And what you were saying, Dr. Abdul Cotter, is that for this study, for the ACEs study, they were finding that there's a physiological effect of the trauma, and that there are illnesses as a result, and actually a decline in some people's life expectancy as a result of the impact of this. So it may be that they've been able to deal with whatever the issues are on the surface having to do with this trauma, maybe deal with the alcoholism of a parent or the abuse of a parent, and having gone on with their lives and gotten married and had children, but that physiologically there's something that continues to happen.
Mm-hmm. So I think the way that we can conceptualize that is related to stress and what people are calling toxic stress or a stress level that it becomes unhealthy and actually toxic to the body. We understand that stress is important for us as human beings. We need a certain level of stress in our life for motivation.
Correct.
But we should have buffers. We should have buffers that we get a break from that stress, or we have people in our lives who help us get through that stress so that we can have some reprieve from that stress. However, there are many children that don't get a break. And then that stress can become toxic because they are constantly living in a state of fear. When we're living in that state of fear, what happens when we're, say, you know, just a moment of stress, something happens. I'm about to cross the street and a truck is coming towards me. I will have a physiologic response to that. And there will be a quick physiologic response with my heart pumping and ready to go.
That's a good thing.
And that's a good thing, right. And we need that. But then there's this longer physiologic response, which is mostly related to cortisol. Mm-hmm. And so what we understand is that children that are living in that toxic stress are having unhealthy levels of cortisol. And as we know, cortisol can affect every organ in our body, but predominantly things like the endocrine system, our immune system, our cardiovascular system. So then when we look, okay, we have a system that cortisol has been affecting for a long period of time, and it's not going to be responding appropriately, what happens over time? We have cardiovascular disease, we have cancer, we have other immune dysfunction because of that.
So what do you do with children? I mean, if you know that they come from a traumatic background and you're working with children that are in situations that come from abusive backgrounds or from drug abuse and or foster, they're in foster situations, knowing that ACEs study, what is it that you create within that environment to try and have an impact on that?
I think the first important component is assessment and a multidisciplinary assessment, that we look at this from a medical lens to look at the health, but we also look at it through behaviors. We look at it through emotion. We look at environment. What are things about the environment that we can help to support, as well as specific programming? So whether that's a specific therapy that they should be engaged in or a special developmental preschool where they're more developmentally understanding of a child. We were talking earlier about temper tantrums. So at certain ages, temper tantrums are developmentally appropriate. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when children are exposed to chronic stress, they will have developmental delays in different areas, including in social emotional functioning. So they may be acting in some ways younger than they are. So we have to kind of understand where they are developmentally, even though maybe cognitively they are at their age level chronologically, but in other areas they're not. So it's very important to have this like holistic way of looking at that child to understand all the different pieces that can then support the child. And it's important then to reevaluate, how are these different things that we've been thinking about and thinking will help that child, then are they really being helpful? And where are the areas that we can adjust to improve that? And we talked about medication before, and we definitely try to avoid medication in children. But sometimes we find that maybe a five-year-old who we've tried all these different modalities, and they have in-home behavioral support, and we're trying to do OT work to work with their sensory differences, and they're just not showing the improvement that we would like to see them. They're just really suffering. We will look at some of those, maybe those physiologic things that are getting in the way. Maybe it's sleep. Because as we know, if we don't get good sleep, we don't do so well the next day, right? For as adults and healthily functioning people. And so if you can imagine a child who is chronically sleep deprived, they're going to have more problems.
If a child is pumping a lot of cortisol because they're in a heightened anxiety, mm-hmm. wouldn't they also have difficulty sleeping?
That's a possibility. What we do see based on some studies on trauma studies looking at cortisol, some of the cortisol levels are high and some of them are low and some of them are flattened. So different children react differently, but they have abnormal cortisol levels at different times. We're supposed to have a variation during the day with the high level starting in the early morning, but theirs will be different. It will be high at different times. So sleep can be one of them. So sometimes we do recommend things to help them sleep, not that we want it to be a long-term thing, but something maybe we can get them so they're better rested so they can then have the benefit of all these modalities that we're providing for them and actually show some improvement in those areas.
Is there more of an approach now to put the physical and the mental together? Because there's really been years and years of kind of seeing those things as separate. First, you mm-hmm. approach it looking at, is there any physicality to it? And when that fails, then you go to, is there anything?
It has improved a lot. I mean, we have a much better technology to understand the brain and what the brain is doing under different levels of stress and trauma. So that has helped us a lot. We have better explanations for that, and people are more educated. Professionals are more educated around the use of it. So you see more understanding and insight in it. But I still find a lot of people trying to take some very cognitive sort of approaches or very just strictly behavioral approaches. And so we still have a long ways to go.
And what's the downside to that? And describe if people are trying to take a simple, you know, really strict behavioral approach, what mm-hmm. that looks like first.
Well, I mean, just imagine yourself in the morning trying to get ready for work and you're late and you can't find your keys. That's not a time where you're going to sit down and be able to do some math problems. It's just you don't have, because that part of your brain is not functioned. You can't focus. And so if you're going to sit down and try to reason with the child or talk with the child or institute a behavioral plan or try to get them to follow a reward system to earn a certain amount of tokens to get a reward at the end of the day, or to even try to get them to have insight into some of their behavior, they're just not going to be able to do it because they're in this place of hypervigilance, of fight or flight, and they are always, the brain's always on alert, looking for damage. I sometimes try to explain to parents that it's kind of like your smoke alarm in your house. The toast burns and the smoke alarm goes off because that's its job.
Right.
It is designed to let you know when it detects smoke. It's not going to tell you if the house is actually burning down or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's for you to decide. So you have to realize that the child's brain is smelling smoke based on the trauma and their earlier life experiences, or as an adult, what you're doing is you're smelling smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And so that part of your brain is just going off. And it's very hard to think or problem solve when you are under that kind of heightened state of hypervigilance.
Would you say, too, that what's traumatic for me, what would be traumatic for me would trigger a traumatic response for me may not be the same
absolutely.
As for someone else? So
yeah.
The definition of trauma is as different as the people that could experience
There's different definitions of trauma. Sometimes I talk about it as kind of a big T trauma or a small T trauma.
Mm-hmm.
The big T is just the things that you would imagine, you know, major car accidents, you see a death. There's just really big incidents that happen in your life.
The loss of a grandparent you were really close to.
Yeah, absolutely. Or,
yeah.
And then you can have small T trauma, just the little daily mm-hmm. life hassles that seem to add up over time.
Mm-hmm.
Struggling for the single mom to, you know, make it every month. All these little things just can add up. And some of the research actually shows that small traumas over time equal what a big trauma would be to someone. And that's why a lot of times we think it's just life. We're just living life. We're just dealing with the daily hassles. That's how life goes. And so we don't have good coping mechanisms for that. And there's not a referral for those daily life hassles. So, but those are also a big impact. So, and personality can make a big difference. Some people,
right.
like this movie suggests, are resilient to certain things. They're more resilient to certain areas.
Yeah.
And other people are not. It has a lot to do with the frequency, the impact, the age in which it occurred, and your own temperament.
And with the work that you're doing with adoption, with fostering, is this training that you're giving these parents or these foster parents in how to handle some of these children, what to look for, is that important?
Yeah, so I don't do this as much of the ongoing coaching
right.
of those things, and Ron does a lot more, and the
yeah.
therapists
mm-hmm.
who
right.
meet with the families on a weekly basis.
But the agencies that you work
with. But the agencies do, and we do try to support all the different planning as much as possible to help the family understand the children. So I feel that, for example, part of my job is to help explain how either the trauma may be affecting a child physiologically and then in their behaviors and in their emotions, or how a prenatal substance exposure may be affecting them, and also part of that. And sometimes there's just unknowns, and we just can say we're seeing this and we don't know why, because we don't have that history, we don't have that prenatal
right.
history, but we're going to come up with a plan. And that's why I strongly support constant reevaluation and just reconsidering how are we going, where are we meeting our goals. So it's important to always have that, what are our goals with what we're doing right now. And I feel that we're at an amazing time. Maybe we're not completely caught up with the brain-body connection, but we're at a great time where there's a lot of evidence-based practices
mm-hmm.
that can really help guide us based on solid science on what should be helpful given what we're seeing and what we're thinking about.
You're listening to KCBX, your public radio station, at 90.1 FM, San Luis Obispo, 91.7 FM, Salinas to Paso Robles, 89.5, Santa Barbara, and streaming at kcbx.org. We like to think of childhood as a time of joy and innocence, but for many of us, that's just not true. While formerly controversial, experts now consider the findings of research delving into the science of adverse childhood experiences to be one of the leading causes of things from heart disease to cancer to substance abuse and depression. Extremely stressful experience in childhood can alter brain development and have lifelong effects on health and behavior. My guests are talking more about this, and that's Dr. Nisha Abdul-Qadir, child abuse pediatrician for the County of San Luis Obispo and consulting pediatrician for Martha's Place Children's Center, and Ron Huxley, marriage and family therapist who provides faith-based trauma-informed therapy for individuals and families. The show is live, and you can bring your comments and questions to the discussion. You can call us at 781-3875, 781-3875. What are some of the ways that you help work with or heal clients who have a trauma and you're trying to assist them in coping?
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned already, the education is very important.
Okay.
So we try to help them understand what is going on, because if we can do that, then it's a good basis for the interventions that we're going to do next, to understand why we're doing it. And my goal is always to try to, if I'm working with a parent and a child, for example, to teach that parent what to do. I'm trying to help them provide ongoing support based on what I do and model in the therapy room, so that they can continue to do this outside the therapy room, because they're going to spend the majority of the time with them and they need practical tools about things to do. So educating them on what's happening with the child, what might be our best sort of understanding, our guess at times, understanding what are some of the common treatments for that, and educating them, those are hugely important. We also want to be able to establish a place of safety, because anyone who goes through trauma often feels unsafe. It's a very common sort of belief or thought to have that I'm not safe. The world is not safe. My caregivers are not safe. Mm-hmm. I can't trust other people. And so this is kind of a real basis. So you want to really take the time, answer their questions, be able to make sure they feel safe, and take the time to engage with them. You want to be able to do things with children, for example, like doing some art, doing some games, doing some things that they are comfortable with, and have your office, you know, set in a way that makes them feel comfortable to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So once you've established sort of that safety and the education, then you can begin doing some interventions. To be trauma-informed in your therapy, you want to be able to take what you know as far as science goes and then be able to apply some of that to the work that you're doing. The interesting piece is that the brain is very malleable, and the nervous system can be very malleable, especially with children who are always changing and developing and growing. That's good news. So that allows us the opportunity to work with the child's development to help them, either through teaching them some social skills or learning how to stop their bodies, how to be aware of the signals that are going on in their body so that they can manage themselves better. Also learning some ways to communicate, giving the parents some insights of what the behaviors are and what's happening and why, so that they don't feel like just a bad parent or the child's manipulative. That tends to be the kind of the labels and concerns we have
right. In
our relationship, so they can communicate better and then begin to develop maybe a reward system within the home that actually can work. But I also try to work directly with the nervous system too. And so there are some very evidence-based practices out there, such as EMDR, which stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's a real mouthful. That is one of the number one tools for individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And you can modify this for children as well. And you can teach them how to utilize the same tools, which will actually help them manage their nervous system and give them a sense of control over themselves. And they can then help increase that more of a parasympathetic, relaxed response in their body. And then also understanding the sensory-based systems and what's going on, why trauma may impact the sensory system. So Are we sensory seekers? We're always touching things, looking for information around us. Are we sensory defensive? These lights are above my head are, you know, hurting me, and the sound is irritating me, or the clothes that I'm wearing are annoying, and I can't stand these socks. And so then we just try some practical things like, well, if the child is auditory defensive, then we can use some headphones sometimes that helps them. Mm-hmm. Block out signs when they're doing sounds when they're doing homework. Maybe there's some music, light music, when they're trying to go to sleep at night, so they don't hear noises and constantly wake up. So, and if they are touch sensitive, then provide them with a lot of things that they can then hold and touch and that are sensory based. A lot of kids who have trauma, it's very common.
Yeah.
You notice kids like stuffed animals,
right.
But what I notice with kids who've gone through trauma or in utero drug exposure or other things that have impacted them emotionally or physically is they like a lot of stuffed animals. I mean, their bed is covered with them, and they like a lot of blankets. Sometimes their body just wants a little extra weight. That helps them feel a little more pressure, which internalized creates a signal of safety. I feel safe. I feel cuddled. I feel held. I feel swaddled. And that can be just a really simple response that a parent can do to help a child who's dealing with a lot of emotional dysregulation and having some behavioral outbursts.
Wow, that's interesting. Now, you have talked about the children that have in utero exposure to drugs. And is that a problem in this county?
Yeah, it is a problem to many different substances. And as we all know, alcohol is probably one of the most dangerous substance for a mother to use during pregnancy because there are lifetime effects from the poison effect of alcohol on the developing brain. So we may have children that don't have the facial features that we think of with prenatal alcohol exposure or the growth deficiencies we may think of with severe prenatal alcohol exposures, but they're showing other behavioral and emotional regulation issues. And so if we think about a child, particularly one that had prenatal alcohol exposure and then suffered trauma, they are already a vulnerable individual coming into this world because their brain is developing differently and has a lot of challenges. Now put that trauma on top of it, and it's really they're really not having the buffering and the self-regulation that they need to help to have the resilience to get through some of these issues. And so sometimes we just can see that children with the type of interventions that Ron was talking about are just not showing the type of movement ahead that we'd hope for. And so sometimes we can kind of feel that maybe there's this other component of a silent exposure that we didn't see before. We see exposures to opiates, which is a big epidemic in our country as far as opiate use. And the NICUs are being heavily burdened by that because a lot of these children need to stay an excessive amount of time as they're coming off that. They're withdrawing from the opiates, and then they themselves may need to have morphine, phenobarbital, other substances to keep them calm during that withdrawal. Over time, they can generally do quite well as far as being in school and their motor skills and communication, but it's putting their development basically on hold because if you're a baby sedated for a couple of months, we're not really going to be expecting them to be able to interact with the environment and most particularly interact with the caregivers that they're starting to develop those attachment with.
For these in utero exposures, does it take daily exposures, say, to alcohol for a child to have the effects of prenatal exposure?
No, not at all. With alcohol, we probably know the worst exposure would be a binge exposure. So a high level of alcohol in a woman who doesn't drink on a regular basis, that can be have the highest toxicity to the child. But it can be so that one time alcohol exposure can be, or it can be a frequent exposure. Things like opiates probably are more that long-term, especially in that third trimester where the baby has then become used to having that in their body and go through withdrawal. But we know some prescription medications as well can have effects like benzodiazepines and antidepressants. And we're seeing about a 300% increase in the amount of pregnant women using antidepressants. And we really don't know on the long-term what that's going to do and how that might affect their children. And of course, it's a situation where there's a risk-benefit. If we have a truly depressed mother or expecting mother, and the doctor's considering that it's in her best interest and the baby's best interest for her to be on that medication, then it's important that she's on it. But we also have to understand that it's something that changes how our neurotransmitters work, and it may have an effect on the child as well. Yeah. And I think some of these things get very confusing because, like, just as Ron was describing something that sounded just like ADHD, he was just describing something that sounds like a lot of autism spectrum disorder with the sensory thing.
Yeah.
And there are children that have fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and autism, but sometimes they're just fetal alcohol spectrum disorders with sensory processing.
Sure.
And so it takes, as we say, it takes a long time to peel that onion. And sometimes we never get down to the bottom, but we're constantly trying to figure out how we can best serve that child.
And in terms of the, you know, for those children that are exposed to those traumas, whether it's trauma from early exposure to chemicals or to abuse, is there wisdom in that the earlier the treatment and intervention, the better the person does, or does it make a difference?
I think overall it does make a difference. The earlier you catch things, the quicker you can change the outcome. One, you're going to have more time to work with the individual, so they have more opportunity for interventions, and you're going to prevent whatever toxicity is going on in that child's life and be more active to change that as quickly as possible. But there's always hope. It doesn't matter what age we do catch someone, even someone who is an adult and their later years, we can always do things to help improve the quality of their life. They may still have the effects of some of these things going on in their life or be dealing with some heart disease and other things, but it doesn't mean that they have to be in a constant state of suffering.
Right.
And that tends to be a very helpful thing. And I try to make sure everyone who comes in, that'd be the other component to interventions, which is just making sure that people realize that there is always hope. There is no reason why someone has to continue to live in a very unpleasant situation or deal with these problems ongoing. It's going to be challenging, perhaps, and maybe challenging ongoing, but it doesn't mean that they can't have a good life and the child can't have a good life. And that's encouraging. People really need to hear that.
Absolutely. I'm Chris Kington, and I'm with you on Central Coast Voices on KCBX-FM, the Central Coast Public Radio station from Salinas to Ventura. If you just joined us and you'd like to hear this entire show, you can go to our website at kcbx.org. Our shows are recorded and archived on KCBX's website and are available when you want, so you can listen to them when it's most convenient for you. We have about 15 minutes left with my guest today, Dr. Nisha Abdul-Qadir, child abuse pediatrician for the County of San Luis Obispo and consulting pediatrician for Martha's Place Children's Center. Ron Huxley, marriage and family therapist who provides faith-based and trauma-informed therapy for individuals and families. And you can reach us at 781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. Talk a little bit, Ron, about the Faith in Motion seminars, because you found that in some cases with individuals who've had severe trauma in their lives, sometimes faith-based kinds of intervention have been helpful.
Absolutely. Trauma doesn't happen in a vacuum, and it cuts across all different systems throughout all of our culture and the places in which we interact. And faith is certainly a big factor for many people, and it's an area where a lot of people do get a lot of feeling of hope and comfort and a sense of community and protection. And so that can give them a lot of strength through some difficult things, and it can be a key to a lot of people's ability to be resilient and to not continue to think about their lives in a sort of negative way, that because this has happened to me, I'm a bad person, or that I'm going to always have to live, or problems are always going to happen in my life. So that can be a major area to come in and help change some of that negative cognitions or negative thoughts that people have as a result of trauma. And the Faith in Motion are some local seminars that I've been asked to present in collaboration with the Department of Social Services in San Luis Obispo County, as well as with many of the different churches and faith-based organizations. And so we're looking at some trauma-informed care, specifically towards parents, resource parents, foster parents, adoptive parents, and then from taking it from a faith-based perspective.
Mm-hmm.
How does this how can this be addressed if we look at it not just from the mind, our thoughts and emotions, not just the body, but what about the spirit too?
Mm-hmm. Which all three of those things go into connection with the person, regardless of what the person's religious preference
Absolutely.
Is. You're talking about their spirit,
yeah,
not necessarily what the belief is.
Yeah, and we're not talking specific about beliefs or denominations
right.
or religious institutions, but we're talking about their sense that there's something more than just themselves, what their
mm-hmm.
purpose is, what their calling is. And who is there to look out for them. All those things can help people manage the trauma and stress that they're going through.
You were talking when you go into sessions, when you start treatment with children, or I'm assuming adults, just to be able to get to a place of feeling trust,
mm-hmm.
feeling safety, I think.
Yes.
Safe is
safety,
what you were
yeah.
talking
they
about.
They can be synonymous. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Do you also find that in many cases the parents may also have had some kind of history of some kind of trauma or abuse in their own life, and maybe that's also
mm-hmm.
an issue for them?
Yeah, it's really perceptive. And I think Dr. Abdul-Qadir and I both see that often what's presenting problems may be the child and what's going on at school or home. But oftentimes as we're exploring and doing a complete assessment, we're realizing that the parent has also gone through some trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It's ironic sometimes that if a child is at 9 and experiencing some type of issues in the life, that sometimes exploring the parent's life at 9, it also comes up. I'm not sure what all the synchronicity is around some of these things, but many times just by asking the parent as you're doing a complete assessment, have you ever experienced any trauma in your life? Of course, we're always wanting to look for, you know, did you use drugs or alcohol while you were pregnant with the child? Because that could be a big issue of what we're dealing with. Also looking at the genetic components to common mental health disorders, depression, anxiety, ADHD, other things can often fall within families. You can see that. And then just asking things like, you know, did a lot of different family members use substances, or was there divorces, or were there domestic violence, were there an absent father or mother figure? All these things can dramatically affect a child because we're all on that family tree. And so, you know, you shake one limb, other limbs move too. And so that can have a huge effect. And sometimes if the parent was traumatized and then they see working with their child, that can trigger them because maybe they didn't deal with their own traumas, and what's going on, the child triggers their traumas.
And they're reliving it.
And they're starting to relive it now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going to take a call here from Marlene. Hi, Marlene. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi. Did you
mm-hmm.
have a comment or question?
Yes. I just wanted to say how glad I am that they have programs like this now and that they're addressing things early. Myself and my younger brother and sister were in a car accident when we were younger, and our dad was killed, and we were all right there. And in those days and age, it was, you know, kids are resilient, they'll be okay, they'll bounce back. But we're in our 60s now, and we're really now just seriously getting help for the results of what we suffered.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just champion you for what you're doing now. Like I said, it's never too late to get help, and it's better late than never to do that.
Oh, that's one thing I wanted to express, because if I come across anyone in my life that maybe shares some issues, I want to encourage everyone to get help. If something's not right, if you're struggling with something and depression or anger issues or whatever, to get help, because we've suffered longer than we should have, but at least now there is help, and it makes a huge difference. So, but I'm just thrilled to hear about your program and addressing these issues sooner rather than later for young people.
Well, thank you for calling in, Marlene. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, and good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. We have about 5 or 6 minutes, so I want to make sure that we hit points that you guys, 5 minutes, I'm hearing from Bree over here. So I want to make sure that I hit points that you want to ensure we get to.
Well, one thing that I would just like to comment, and I really appreciate having Marlene call, because she's an individual and an adult who has had that trauma, and she's where she is today, and she's able to address those needs. And I oftentimes, with the work I do, I look at big studies and public health data and big numbers, and you know, the more ACEs you have, the poorer the outcome. And those are big studies. It's not the individual, and I think it's always important to go back to that individual and just reiterate what Ron's saying, is that we all have hope and we all have this chance to make a change. And sometimes, though, it's hard to find the people to make that connection to how do we do that change. Because I think in our county, I believe we have great outreach for the birth to five population through services through First Five. And the perinatal to five group that is constantly letting pediatricians know, schools know about different services and options. And so I feel that that is an area, and importantly so, but that it's not so hard to find the roadmap to access those services. I do think it's harder and more challenging as people get older, based on things like insurances and what programs are available. And then when we live in a smaller community, the resources are also limited too. And I don't know if Ron, if you have anything that you can recommend to just help. How do adults find that help?
Yeah, there are a lot of resources out there. It does require a little bit of digging around sometimes, a little searching. But this is a great county for providing resources. I think they're really cutting edge in a lot of ways. In my career, I've worked with 5 different counties throughout the state, and this has really been one of the most personable and people on the cutting edge of providing services. And they're just to have a social services that connects with the local churches and to do things like that, and just be able to try to bridge gaps. I think that's a huge credit to the local institutions. But yeah, I would definitely start by just asking someone you know if they've heard of somebody, doing some searches online for people. And always remember that you're a consumer. You don't have to just pick the first person that's out there. You can search around. You can ask questions, pick and choose them. A lot of times we just kind of pick whatever therapist is on our insurance panel, and we don't pick someone that we actually feel good about. If you go to the session with somebody, or you go to see somebody, you're not comfortable, you don't feel safe, then keep looking.
And also note, I think what you're saying is that you're never too old, as
never.
Marlene attested to. You know, if something's happened, there's never a time that it's too late to do something about making a change in your life and getting more comfort and being able to resolve something.
Exactly. Don't wait until you don't have a choice.
Yes.
It's better to do it up front. Be courageous. Ask for help.
Yeah, exactly. I want to thank my guests today, Dr. Nisha Abdul-Khader, child abuse pediatrician for the County of San Luis Obispo and consulting pediatrician for Martha's Place Children's Center. Ron Huxley, who's a licensed marriage and family therapist who provides faith-based trauma-informed therapy for individuals and families here in San Luis Obispo County. Next week, please join your host, Fred Monroe, as he talks with experts about the proposed dramatic cuts to the EPA and how those cuts would affect the federal environmental protection programs to protect air, water, and the environment. We always appreciate your suggestions for future shows. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining us on Central Coast Voices.
Thank you.